From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Even before Colin Powell's presentation to the UN Security Council, Peter Galbraith supported a war to overthrow Saddam Hussein. On today's Fresh Air, Galbraith explains his position as a self-described liberal interventionist. While serving as senior advisor to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in the early 90s, he helped smuggle out of Iraq 14 tons of files which documented Saddam Hussein's crimes against the Kurds. He now teaches at the National War College. Also, we check in with psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton, who has written extensively about nuclear war and apocalyptic terrorism. We'll talk with him about the march toward war. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Secretary of State Colin Powell made a presentation to the UN Security Council today, saying Iraq has defied the world and is still hiding weapons of mass destruction. Powell said UN weapons inspectors can't get the full truth because they're being deceived. He added that Saddam Hussein won't stop until something stops him.
How much longer are we willing to put up with Iraq's noncompliance before we, as a council, we as the United Nations say, enough, enough?
Powell used video, satellite photos, and intercepted phone calls to support his case, but Iraq's UN ambassador, Mohammed al-Duri, said the United States' case was a fabrication. On Capitol Hill, many lawmakers were pleased with Powell's remarks, though many disagreed on what should happen next, NPR's Andrea Seabrook reports.
Delaware Democrat Joe Biden supports action against Iraq, but wants President Bush to outline its long-term costs. Biden is the ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and said when most Americans imagine a new war with Iraq, they mistakenly see it as much like the Gulf War.
It will be quick. It will be essentially bloodless in terms of American lives. And Johnny will come marching home in a matter of days or weeks or at the latest months. Johnny will not come marching home.
Biden warned that tens of thousands of troops would have to stay in Iraq for years to protect oil fields and prop up an interim government. He called on President Bush to better inform Americans of what to expect after a war with Iraq. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, the Capitol.
A New Jersey man accused of selling false documents to two of the September 11th hijackers has been freed after 6 months in jail. Local prosecutors dropped 26 of 27 charges against the man with little explanation. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
Civil liberties groups had criticized local prosecutors for holding Muhammad El-Atrice on secret evidence. One prosecutor had told the court El-Atrice was being investigated for terror connections, and a court brief said the safety of millions of people justified the extraordinary secrecy. The judge had then set El-Atrice's bond at $500,000, even though most of the charges against him were misdemeanors. El-Atrice contested the secret evidence. An appeals judge then ruled that only the federal government can assess a national security risk. Back in court yesterday, a shaken El-Atrice fought back tears as he admitted selling fake papers to hundreds of illegal immigrants, but he denied having any knowledge of terror plots. Under a plea agreement, El-Atrice will be sentenced to a year's probation. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 28 points to close at 7,985 in heavy trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index lost 4 points to close at 1,301. This is NPR News. North Korea announced today that it has reactivated a nuclear reactor that was shut down for nearly 10 years as part of an agreement with the United States. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld called the situation a dangerous one and said U.S. forces are ready to respond to what he called North Korea's terrorist regime, if necessary. Palestinian officials say a Palestinian policeman was killed by Israeli troops in the West Bank, and the body of a woman was found in the rubble of a house demolished by Israeli bulldozers in Gaza. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Palestinian officials said Israeli troops and bulldozers today entered the Muwazi refugee camp in Gaza and demolished the home of Baha Saeed, a militant from Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat's Fatah faction. Palestinian officials said the body of Saeed's 65-year-old stepmother, Camila, was found under the debris. The Israeli army said it was checking the report. The army said Saeed killed two Israelis in an attack on a Jewish settlement in Gaza 2 years ago before he was shot dead. Meanwhile, in the West Bank city of Qalqilya, Palestinian officials said Israeli troops raided a Palestinian Special Forces headquarters, killing a 20-year-old policeman. In the West Bank city of Hebron, Israeli troops sealed Palestinian stores that remained open despite the curfew. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
NASA experts say they're skeptical of the theory that a falling chunk of foam insulation could have damaged the thermal tiles on the Space Shuttle Columbia. Shuttle Program Manager Ron Dittemore said it didn't make sense to NASA engineers that a piece of debris could be the root cause of the disaster. He said investigators are now looking elsewhere for a potential cause. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM, the nature of what's to come at ADMworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Even before Colin Powell's presentation to the United Nations, my guest Peter Galbraith supported a war against Iraq to overthrow Saddam Hussein. Galbraith describes himself as a liberal interventionist. From 1979 to 93, he worked with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee as an advisor on the Persian Gulf, South Asia, and North Africa. For over a decade, he's worked closely with the Kurds, documenting Saddam Hussein's campaign against them. In 1992, Galbraith helped smuggle 14 tons of Iraqi documents out of the Kurdish region that outlined Saddam Hussein's atrocities against the Kurds. Galbraith is now a professor of national security studies at the National War College in Washington, D.C. In 1993, he became the first U.S. ambassador to Croatia. I asked him if watching the effects of the NATO bombing in the Balkans helped convince him that we should intervene now in Iraq.
The thing I came away with from the Balkans was, first, that intervention can do some good. There's no question that in Bosnia, the United States intervention, the NATO bombing, saved many, many more lives than were cost by that action. It helped bring the war to an end. It was a war in which 200,000 people had been killed, and it enabled Bosnia to get on with the process of reconstruction, and it is admittedly slowly becoming a more normal part of Europe. Iraq, in the 30 years that Saddam Hussein has been in power, at least 500,000 Iraqis have died as a result of actions taken by Saddam Hussein. But sooner or later, I think it's likely to come to some kind of military action. If it's sooner, we're simply going to save the lives of Iraqis.
Let's look at some of the possible scenarios if we do overthrow Saddam Hussein. Scenarios for a post-Saddam government. What's your sense of what the best-case scenario would be?
Well, the nature of what follows depends on, in good measure, on how the war proceeds. In the best case, nobody wishes to fight for Saddam Hussein. You have a situation in Iraq in which 80% of the population are Kurds, Shiites, or Christians. That is from groups that have been brutally repressed by Saddam Hussein. They welcome the United States as liberators, and those segments that do support Saddam, which are very limited, come to the conclusion that there is no point in standing with a dictator who is, in any event, going to fall. And so you have an orderly process. That obviously will make it easier to set up a post-Saddam government than in some other circumstances. But I think necessarily there will be a period of U.S. military occupation. But I believe that we should move quickly to setting up an Iraqi government. I mean, the Iraqis are a sophisticated people with a high level of education. Iraq is today very much a third world country as a result of what Saddam Hussein has done to the country. But But it wasn't. It was a country making great progress back in the late 1970s, and in which a lot of people have gotten educated, a lot of professional people. And those are the people who ought to be involved in rebuilding the country. Now, we're not going to find anybody inside Iraq who can be part of the government, except from the Kurdish area, which has been free from Saddam's control for 11 years, because anybody inside the country who might have opposition tendencies either has kept them very secret and is not known, or if it is known, he's in prison or dead. So I think necessarily a future Iraqi government should come from the opposition. It should be set up quickly. It should work with the American military occupation forces, but the United States shouldn't itself get into the business of running Iraq. This really is for the Iraqis to do, and they are very competent and able to do it.
How long do you think the United States would have to keep a military presence in Iraq in order to make it possible for, you know, a new government and for elections to proceed in some kind of orderly fashion?
I think it would take at least a year before you can hold elections. It's not just a matter of the process of preparing for elections, of developing an electoral roll, taking a census. But there also have to be a process of purging the Ba'ath Party, purging the security services, which are pervasive in this society. In essence, Iraq is going to need to have a period of denazification. There will be some institutions that simply will have to be abolished outright. This would include the security services, Saddam's version of the Ba'ath Party. Other institutions will have to be completely remade. I think it's inconceivable to me that any person who has served as a judge in Saddam's Iraq could possibly continue to be a judge in post-Saddam Iraq, because inevitably this person has been involved in the enforcement of tainted law that grossly violates human rights. So that whole process has to take place, I think, before you can go to elections.
Peter Galbraith, you were America's first ambassador to Croatia after Croatia was established as Yugoslavia dissolved. And you know very well what happened in the Balkans. You know, it's a multi-ethnic region that started feuding with each other after Yugoslavia broke up and after that region was held together by a dictator. If the United States ousts Saddam Hussein, do you think that there will be a lot of fighting between the ethnic and religion groups in Iraq, such as the Shia and the Sunni Muslims and the Kurds?
There is not a lot of history of intercommunal or interethnic conflict in Iraq. But I think this cannot be excluded once the dictatorship is gone. Actually, I think the greater parallel to what happened in Yugoslavia relates to the situation of the Kurds. Yugoslavia, you had the Tito dictatorship. He held the country together. And then after he died, and 10 years after he died, with the end of the Cold War, there were democratic elections, and its constituent components basically split apart. And that was because, in the end, the constituent components of Yugoslavia didn't feel Yugoslav. They felt that they were Slovene, Croat, Serb, and so forth. Well, in Iraq, the problem is that the Kurds, who live in a geographically defined area in the north, who have been de facto independent for 11 years, don't feel Iraqi. Over the last 11 years, the Iraqi identity has been disappearing in the north. For example, the language used is no longer Arabic, but Kurdish. The schools teach in Kurdish. There's been a flowering of media, 20 television stations of different political views, all of this in Kurdish. For younger people, they don't really have a memory of Iraq. And for older people, the memory of Iraq is a nightmare. And so I do have concerns as to whether over the long term Iraq is going to be sustainable as a unified and democratic state, which are what President Bush has articulated as U.S. goals.
And just looking down the line, does that possibly lead to another war?
It doesn't necessarily lead to a conflict within Iraq if there is a clear definition, an agreed definition of what the boundaries of the Kurdish region are. But at the present time, that issue hasn't been settled. If there are agreed boundaries, then the separation of Kurdistan could be something as benign as the breakup of Czechoslovakia, which simply and divided into two countries quietly and with virtually no fuss.
My guest is Peter Galbraith. He teaches at the National War College. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Peter Galbraith. He's a former senior advisor to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and served as the first U.S. ambassador to Croatia. The Kurds have a deep hatred of Saddam Hussein. He gassed the Kurds, and he exiled a lot of Kurds and destroyed some of their villages. You helped uncover some of Saddam Hussein's human rights violations against the Kurds. What are some of the things you helped uncover?
The first thing that I discovered was in 1987, when for completely fluky reasons, I was given permission to go to the north of Iraq, to the Kurdish region. And as I traveled from the last Arab town into the Kurdish region, I noticed that things that I expected to be there weren't there. There were villages on the map that we had that simply didn't exist anymore. And as I went on, I saw villages and towns in the process of being destroyed. For example, on one side of the road, there'd be nothing but rubble, and on the other side of the road, there'd be abandoned houses with bulldozers that were parked there clearly to continue the job of destruction. And it became clear to me that there was this process which ultimately destroyed 4,000 villages and towns in Kurdistan of wiping out the rural areas of Kurdistan. And the population was then being concentrated into what the Iraqi regime called victory cities, but what were effectively concentration camps of some 50,000 people each, in which the population was very carefully guarded without possibility of employment, dependent on government-issued rations. So that was one of the atrocities.
Well, let me stop you right there and ask you, what did you do with that information when you realized that Saddam Hussein was destroying Kurdish villages?
I was working for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee at the time, and I included it in the report, which was part of a larger study that we were doing of the Iran-Iraq War. But frankly, at that time, like the Reagan administration, we were more concerned about what might happen if Iran won in the Iran-Iraq War. And so this information did not get a lot of focus. But I had it in the back of my mind. And a year later, when Kurdish villagers crossed into Turkey, reporting that Iraq had used chemical weapons, I went back and I thought about those destroyed villages, and I put the two together, and I came to the conclusion that what was really going on was a strategy aimed at eliminating the Kurdish presence in Iraq, that this was, in fact, a policy of genocide. It wasn't completed genocide. It was part of a process. And so I went to the chairman of the committee, Senator Claiborne Pell, and said, you know, we need to do something about this. He agreed. He asked me to draft legislation, which I did, that imposed comprehensive sanctions on Iraq. It was called the Prevention of Genocide Act. Got Senator Helms, who was a very conservative Republican and the ranking Republican on the committee, to join him. Senator Gore, Senator Byrd, the majority leader at the time. And we got this legislation through the Senate in a single day. And then I went out with a junior staffer on the committee named Chris Van Hollen. Actually, he's just now been elected as a Democratic member of Congress from Maryland. And we went all along the Iraq-Turkey border talking to these refugees who had just come out. There were about 65,000 of them, and all of them, virtually all of them, had been witnesses to the chemical weapons attacks. And we interviewed hundreds who described firsthand what had happened, many of whom had actually seen family members or friends or acquaintances die before their eyes. But it was a very, very brutal campaign. Overall, we documented in that between the 25th and 28th of August 1988, 49 villages had been attacked. But it turned out these attacks had been going on since 1987, and perhaps as many as 180 villages and towns were attacked by Iraqi aircraft using chemical weapons.
Now, the Anti-Genocide Act that you mentioned passed the Senate, but it didn't finally pass Congress.
No, it did not. It was vehemently opposed by the Reagan administration, which, however, agreed that Iraq had used chemical weapons. But the Reagan administration's position was that taking action was premature, and so they were able to derail the process in the House of Representatives. I think it was a great tragedy that, this legislation didn't pass, because I think Saddam got the message that while his atrocious acts might generate protests, nobody, in fact, was really prepared to take action against him. And I think had comprehensive sanctions passed, he might have thought twice before he invaded Kuwait. He might have thought there would be consequences from doing it. Incidentally, it's often argued that unilateral sanctions don't do any good. But in this case, even though the sanctions bill never actually became law, even though it was simply a threat that it would become law, it did have one very positive effect, which is that Iraq never again used chemical weapons against the Kurds.
Now, something else you did regarding the Kurds, you were one of two people who smuggled out Iraqi documents documenting human rights violations and atrocities committed against the Kurds. What were the documents? How did you get them?
In March of 1991, there was an uprising in northern Iraq, and the Kurds took over all the Kurdish-majority cities and towns. And when they did that, they captured the buildings and the records of the Iraqi secret services as well as of the Ba'ath Party. They took these records to the mountains so that when the Iraqis retook the Kurdish area at the end of March, they didn't recapture, they didn't get the records back. I learned of those records in March of 1991 because I was in northern Iraq as the uprising was collapsing. But there was nothing to be done about it then, but I had it in my mind. And when I went back in September of 1991, because the U.S. had created a safe area in which the Kurds then had started to run their own affairs, I talked to Jalal Talabani, who was one of the two main Kurdish leaders, and he told me, indeed, that most of the documents had been rescued and moved to the mountains. So I said to him, I said, well, if they stay here, you know, there's a good chance that they will fall into Iraqi hands, and anyhow, they won't be useful. And so he said, well, I agree. I think they should go out of Iraq, but I'm not going to give them to the Bush administration. I just don't trust the American administration. He was very angry at the Americans for having called for the uprising and then failed to support it. So he said, I'll give it to you personally. Well, that was a bit of a dilemma because I didn't know what I would do with what turned out to be 14 tons of documents. But in the end, we were able to get them out, actually on U.S. Military aircraft, cooperation of the Pentagon. And then I deposited them in the files of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which meant They went into the U.S. National Archives. A special room was built for them below ground out in Suitland, Maryland. And then Human Rights Watch, the human rights organization, began to do research on them. And they turned out to be extraordinary documents. They were ledgers of executions. They included the orders for the destruction of the villages, what was known as the Anfal campaign. They included orders for the use of special weapons, which meant for chemical weapons. They included the tapes of meetings of the Northern Bureau. One of these tapes, for example, is Ali Hassan Majid, who was the Saddam's cousin who had been put in charge of the North, in which he talks about using chemical weapons. He says, we will use chemical weapons on the Kurds. Who will object? The international community, and here I paraphrase the language, to hell with them. So it is an extraordinary record from the point of view of the Iraqi regime of their activities, and of course it mirrors rather closely what the Senate Foreign Relations Committee documented in terms of the use of chemical weapons and what the Kurds themselves have been reporting.
Why do you think a regime would document atrocities like that, document the destruction of villages, document the use of chemical weapons, document executions? I mean, talk about smoking gun.
That's an interesting question. But regimes do this. In the case of Iraq, I had imagined when I saw some of these documents, particularly videos of executions and torture, that that this was being done out of some by sadists who wanted to, who were sharing their sadistic products with the higher ups who would enjoy seeing people suffering. But as I thought more about it and looked more into it, I realized that that wasn't the case. These were bureaucrats in the security services who were making records of executions, who were keeping records of meetings, who were making videotapes to demonstrate how well they were carrying out their orders. Some of it may have been self-defense, so that they themselves could not have been accused of being soft on the enemy, and some of it may have been in the interests of self-promotion, demonstrating, again, how well it is that you are actually carrying out these instructions.
Peter Galbraith teaches at the National War College in Washington, D.C. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Windham Hill Records, presenting George Winston's new solo piano CD, Night Divides the Day, The Music of the Doors, available at Borders Books and Music. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Peter Galbraith, and he explains why he considers himself a liberal interventionist. And we check in with psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton and talk about how the rhetoric is changing surrounding the possible use of nuclear weapons. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Peter Galbraith. He supports military intervention to overthrow Saddam Hussein and describes himself as a liberal interventionist. He teaches at the National War College and served as America's first ambassador to Croatia. In the late 80s and early 90s, while serving as an advisor to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he helped smuggle out of Iraq 14 tons of Iraqi files documenting human rights abuses against the Kurds. Have your experiences documenting Iraq's human rights abuses against the Kurds played a big part in your analysis that the United States should militarily intervene in Iraq and overthrow Saddam Hussein?
Looking at what the Iraqi regime has done, I've come to the conclusion that it is a fascist regime that bears close resemblance to the fascist regimes in the first half of the 20th century in Europe. It has an official ideology that glorifies one group, the Arabs, over the others. It has engaged in escalating atrocities against the minority that ultimately, in my view, but also in the view of Human Rights Watch, rose to the level of genocide. And I think that it is appropriate for the United States to take action, preferably with others in the international community, preferably but not necessarily pursuant to Security Council authorization, against regimes that commit genocide. Genocide is an internationally recognized crime, and there is a convention to which the U.S. is a party that obliges states to do something to stop and to punish the crime of genocide.
You've described yourself as a liberal interventionist. Is there a difference between a liberal interventionist and a Bush administration interventionist?
Well, I think that there is a place for intervention against regimes that brutally repress their own people, that engage in homicide and genocide, even when there is not some other strategic reason to do it. I suppose the best case would be Rwanda, where the United States didn't have any strategic interest, but a genocide was taking place, and I think we and others should have intervened to try to stop that. The Bush administration has made its case principally on the issue of the threat that Iraq poses. I think Iraq does pose a threat, but probably it's not the most serious threat that we face. For example, one shouldn't speak of weapons of mass destruction generally. There is a difference between chemical and biological weapons on the one hand and nuclear weapons on the other. Iraq is not going to be able to manufacture nuclear weapons under this inspections regime. North Korea is in the process of manufacturing those weapons. So if it was simply on the basis of weapons of mass destruction, then I think North Korea should be our priority. But there are these other issues, and because of the humanitarian issues, I place a greater emphasis on that. And that's why I describe myself as a liberal interventionist.
Now, you've said that you think President Bush faces the legacy of his father's actions and inactions. What do you mean?
Well, in February of 1991, the first President Bush called on the Iraqi people to rise up and overthrow Saddam Hussein. On March 3rd, a rebellion began in the south, and on March 8th, a rebellion began in the north. By the middle of March of 1991, most of Iraq was in the hands of rebels. Saddam was about to topple. At that time, President Bush took the decision to let the rebellion fail. Not just to let it fail, but actually to facilitate its failure. So American troops who were on the Euphrates Valley in southern Iraq permitted Iraqi Republican Guard units to pass by their lines and in some cases through American lines to put down the rebellion in the southern city of Basra and Nasiriyah and in some other places. In the north, General Schwarzkopf allowed the Iraqis to use helicopters against the Kurds. And one has to understand the role of helicopters in the Kurdish psyche. helicopters had often been used to deliver chemical weapons. So for the population in the city, when they saw those helicopters flying, they panicked, they fled. The helicopters also gave the Iraqis intelligence that they could use to target Kurdish militia units. The final thing that happened is that those people in Baghdad and in the Iraqi military who were wavering, trying to figure out whether they should overthrow Saddam or not, looked at what the Bush administration was doing, got the clear message that the Bush administration did not want the rebellion to succeed, and decided to back Saddam. We are dealing, and as a consequence, Saddam stayed in power. We are dealing today with the failure of the first Bush administration to support the rebellion. Now, there's one other very important point about this. The first Bush administration has tried to slough off this question. They've always said, well, we didn't have a mandate to go to Baghdad. This has nothing to do with American troops going to Baghdad. That war was over on the 27th of February, 1991. We're talking about a rebellion that began after the war was over in March of 1991.
Well, what's your understanding of why the first Bush administration allowed the Iraqis to put down the opposition?
The first Bush administration was afraid of the people who were the rebels. This was a rebellion that began in the South, and it was a Shiite rebellion, and which was in the North and was a Kurdish rebellion. And so the first Bush administration was afraid that the Shiites would come under the influence of Iran, which is a Shiite theocracy, and they were afraid that the Kurds would try to create their own independent state and that this would alienate Turkey, who had been a key ally in the Gulf War. Now, there's an irony here, because President Bush had actually called on the Iraqi people to try to overthrow Saddam Hussein, and of course the Iraqi people are overwhelmingly Kurds and Shiites. But the second problem that took place here is that the first Bush administration never talked to anybody in the opposition. There was a ban on talking to the Iraqi Kurds that continued until the beginning of April of 1991. So they had no idea of what the Iraqi Kurds were thinking. They saw them in caricature, and they saw them principally as people who wanted to break up Iraq and who Turkey hated. The irony is that I had invited the Kurdish leadership to meet at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. The meeting actually turned out to be on the 27th of February, the day the war ended. I tried to get them in to see Richard Haass at the NSC. I was told that I was behaving irresponsibly by having contact with them. I was told that the administration's policy was not to get was to get rid of Saddam, but not the regime, and they would certainly not meet with them. The Kurdish leaders then left Washington to go to Ankara at the invitation of President Özal of Turkey. In short, the U.S. administration was trying to be more pure on this question out of deference to Turkey's concern than Turkey itself was. So they didn't appreciate what the agenda was going to be. The irony is that in addition to the fact that Saddam is still in power 12 years later, the Bush administration was forced to reintervene to save the Kurds in April, and by so doing, they actually created the independent, de facto independent Kurdistan that they were afraid of, and that entity has functioned for the last 12 years.
So how do you think these actions of the first Bush administration are playing out now? What are the repercussions now for President Bush?
The current Bush administration is not repeating those mistakes. Paul Wolfowitz, who is the Deputy Secretary of Defense, has known the Iraqi opposition leaders for many years. There are very regular contacts with the Kurdish leaders. They're developing contacts with the Shiite leaders. So I think that they have taken that lesson on board.
Well, finally, do you think we're going to be going to war soon? And do you have any sense of how soon?
I have no inside information, but my sense is that we are going to be going to war, that it will be in the next 6 weeks to 2 months.
And you're optimistic about this?
Going to war is a very momentous decision, and war involves lots of risks, and there'll be risks to the Iraqi people. I mean, one of the things that I worry about is that Saddam might again, with nothing to lose, might again want to use chemical weapons. He probably would like to attack the United States. But he may not be able to do so. The people he can attack are the Kurds in the north and, indeed, even more easily, Shiites in the south. So, I mean, this could end up being very devastating for the Iraqi people. So I think there are lots of risks, but so I don't think anybody can be optimistic, but I do think it is necessary.
Peter Galbraith, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Peter Galbraith teaches at the National War College in Washington, D.C. He is, by the way, the son of John Kenneth Galbraith. Coming up, we check in with psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton on his thoughts about the march to war. This is Fresh Air. Ever since September 11th, we've been checking in from time to time with Dr. Robert J. Lifton, a psychiatrist who's an expert on extremist religions, cult groups, and the appeal of apocalyptic thinking. He's also written about global terrorism and the psychological impact of living in an age of nuclear weapons. Dr. Lifton is currently a visiting professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. We called him to see what he's thinking as America marches toward war. He says he's concerned that if we launch a preemptive military strike on Iraq, we'll be breaking a taboo against attacking a country that hasn't attacked us first. I asked him to explain his concern.
Restraints in international behavior are not always adhered to, but they're very important to try to keep in place. And one taboo, which is a very important restraint, is against attacking a country when you yourself have not been attacked. In that sense, the new American doctrine of preemptive warfare, if carried out in Iraq, would be the breaking down of a very major taboo. And that would encourage and, to a degree, legitimate breaking down taboos on the part of others. And it could very well bring about more sympathy for terrorism, which is also a violation of a taboo against civilians and people who aren't militarily concerned as victims, but that too would be a breaking of a taboo, which would have more support because we ourselves are initiating that violation of taboos. And another possible consequence here could be the use of nuclear weapons, which is the greatest and most important taboo, on the part of one of many different countries.
For years, you've been studying the psychological impact of living in a world with nuclear weapons. You started this kind of study during the Cold War. Now we're living in a post-Cold War world where we're worried about Saddam Hussein having weapons of mass destruction, and at the same time, we're worried about North Korea starting to build nuclear weapons and possibly even give nuclear weapons to other countries or to terrorist groups. And I'm wondering how your thinking is changing as the world situation is changing.
Well, there's still a very grave danger of the use of nuclear weapons, and in fact, that danger is increasing. Before, during the Cold War, we had to be concerned with very large hydrogen bombs in the hands of the two superpowers, one superpower threatening to use it against another, with a real danger of destroying much of the world. Now the danger has shifted more toward relatively smaller nuclear weapons, the so-called Hiroshima temptation, which could be to use a weapon, a nuclear weapon, against a country that doesn't possess them. But the danger of any regional conflict escalating to a nuclear conflict. And that's a real possibility right now. If we attack Iraq, there's a danger that Iraq will respond with some use of weapons of mass destruction. It could be biological or chemical, and there's a danger that Israel may use a nuclear weapon. There's a danger that we, the United States, will use a nuclear weapon, as we've threatened to do, should Iraq or anyone else use weapons of mass destruction. And whenever you escalate violence in a very intense way, the nuclear option is thought about by certain powers who are involved, and you create the danger of what I call an atrocity-producing situation, where a group of people feel impelled to use a nuclear weapon.
So do you find yourself being more worried about the use of nuclear weapons now than you've ever been before?
I am more worried about the use of nuclear weapons now in the post-Cold War era than ever before, because on the one hand, we should be grateful that the Cold War dangers of almost complete world destruction have ameliorated in some degree. But on the other hand, with nuclear proliferation and with what I call trickle-down nuclearism, the nuclear weapons-related passions now affecting smaller and smaller groups, including non-governmental groups like Bin Laden or even Aum Shinrikyo, this increases the danger of the use of a smaller nuclear weapon. And there also are unaccounted for nuclear weapons in the countries of the former Soviet Union, so that all in all, most observers would feel that the danger of nuclear warfare is greater than before, and we have to always be cognizant of that.
One of the things you've thought about a lot is, what does it take for a leader to say, yes, it's justified to use a nuclear weapon? And do you think that that sense of what would make use of a nuclear weapon justifiable has changed?
Well, it has in certain ways, because one very important matter is how much you consider the use of nuclear weapons crossing a dangerous threshold, or alternatively, how much you consider it just another weapon. And unfortunately, this administration, our present administration, has really opted for the latter. They've talked about nuclear weapons as though they were just other weapons, and they've talked about more creative uses of nuclear weapons, for instance, underground uses to attack underground caves or whatever, so that rather than seeing that as a very important threshold to keep as a barrier, we've taken the opposite view of rendering the weapons ordinary and normalizing them and really engaging rhetoric that eases their use. So prior rhetoric, prior policy that justifies and encourages their use on the one hand can combine on the other with a sense of national emergency or threat to so-called national security, and that can be a combination that can lead to their use. We have to start talking and thinking about these things right now before they actually happen.
You've studied the mindset of cult group leaders and terrorists. The Bush administration is making connections between Islamic fundamentalist terrorists and the Iraq regime led by Saddam Hussein. But you've suggested that if we attack Saddam Hussein, it might actually please Bin Laden, assuming Bin Laden's still alive. But make that case for us.
Well, a terrorist like Bin Laden thrives on chaos. I think if I were Bin Laden, I'd welcome an American invasion of Iraq, because that would intensify chaos. It would create something closer to an apocalyptic situation. The use of high-tech weapons, the anger of much of the Islamic world over this use of that weaponry on an Islamic country. All this would be in the direction that Bin Laden seeks, and he would emerge from it stronger, with more appeal, and with better recruiting possibilities.
You were telling me that the head of Aum Shinrikyo, the Japanese cult group that was responsible for the gas attack in the Japanese subway, that he was thrilled by the Gulf War. Why?
That's right. Asahara was thrilled by the Gulf War. On the one, he had a kind of ambivalence. On the one hand, he identified with Saddam and thought that this was another example of American aggression toward a non-white country. But on the other hand, he was very excited by the high-tech weapons that America was using in that Gulf War, because they seemed to be a harbinger of Armageddon, and Armageddon was what he sought. And that's a kind of parallel to what I'm suggesting with bin Laden.
My guest is Dr. Robert J. Lifton. He's now a visiting professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our conversation with psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton. He's written extensively about cult groups, extremist religions, global terrorism, and living in a world with nuclear weapons. We called him to talk about the fear of terrorism, the march toward war, and the horror of the shuttle catastrophe, which briefly knocked war preparations out of the headlines. I think the shuttle disaster has happened at a time when people's emotions are still very raw, because of September 11th and fear of terrorism. Do you think that Americans' grief over the shuttle disaster was deepened by post-September 11th fear and anxiety?
I think it certainly has been. Certainly, the American reaction would be very strong under any conditions, because rendering human these astronauts and their appealing kind of human quality is enough to move the country. But having said that, I think Americans are uneasy and agitated over fear of terrorism and fear of recurrence of terrorist acts, and also over what is immediately happening now in terms of the danger of an American attack on Iraq and what that means for us and what it means for further terrorism in the world. All of these things lead to not only uneasiness but anxiety and intensified grief and fear of loss.
Do you think that that connects to the amount of coverage that the shuttle disaster has been given in the media and the desire of many Americans to stick with it and to kind of keep with that disaster and keep learning as much as they can about it?
To some extent, as painful as the whole shuttle disaster has been, there's some comfort derived by public expressions of grief and some degree of satisfaction in doing that. Sustained coverage of that grief and of the events surrounding the disaster may have the effect of warding off the more difficult questions, the more troubling issues involving the possible invasion of Iraq and the possible intensification of terror that invasion could bring about.
You mean because with the shuttle we're not looking at terrorism, we're looking at something mechanical, something in the structure of the shuttle that went wrong. We don't know exactly what that is yet, but it's not morally ambiguous.
Well, the hope is that we can uncover the technological source of the shuttle disaster, and in that sense, deal with the problem. That may be too simply stated, because the problems are vast and there are issues about human beings in space that many people are raising. But all of this has a certain straightforward quality as compared to the unknowns of an attack on Iraq and the responses of the Islamic world to such an attack. The latter, the attack on Iraq, is a matter of a very painful and dubious decision, as opposed to the focus on the shuttle disaster, which at least brings the country together in shared pain.
As opposed to the division over whether we should invade Iraq.
That's right. Invading Iraq divides the country in the most extreme way, and there are voices on all sides, all of which claim to see things clearly, and everybody perceives dangers. It was rather interesting in one recent news article that one of the people most involved with being an architect for the attack on Iraq called back the interviewer, or told the interviewer, that he has sleepless nights worrying about what I've been calling unintended consequences. That is, that certain things would happen, including further terrorism or the use of some kind of dirty bomb on an American city as a result of an attack on Iraq. So that there's a lot of unease about what looks like a presidential policy.
As a psychiatrist, I'm wondering if you've been thinking a lot about Saddam Hussein's personality and how well-balanced he actually is.
It's very hard to project future events on the basis of the personality, even of demagogic figures like Saddam Hussein. He has shown so many different characteristics, including wild destructiveness, very canny capacity for survival, responsiveness to deterrence, very bad judgment in relation to his own self-interest. He's shown all of those things. Perhaps the lesson should be that we can't predict his exact behavior or that of Iraq in general should we attack that country. And any policy that's based upon an assumption that he'll behave in a particular way, particularly, especially if that's the way that we want him to behave, is really ill-advised.
Dr. Lifton, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Robert J. Lifton is currently a visiting professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. His latest book is Destroying the World to Save It, Om Shinrikyo, Apocalyptic Violence and the New Global Terrorism. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Ancient Herbs, Modern Medicine, Improving Your Health by Combining Chinese Herbal Medicine and Western Medicine, by Henry Han, OMD, Glenn Miller, MD, and Nancy DeVille. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Questlove, the drummer in the hip-hop group The Roots. They have a new CD. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air. Keeping you feeling till you're taking it tossed. And when I'm breaking it off, there's no denying the fact. It's wrong because you got a man who probably playing his part. You probably breaking his heart. He trying to...